finally have something to offer women with ovarian cancer.
Bariatric surgery for obesity.
The long-term benefits of breastfeeding.
And any benefit to non-traditional risk factors for heart disease.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed.
Double T.
Double T. Tell me more about that. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins.
And I'm Rick Lang, president at Double T, that is Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine. Elizabeth, we're back.
Oh, I feel like I need to break into the Ghostbusters theme there, but we'd like to thank everyone who came forward and said, hey, we really miss you. We were so encouraged by your comments, your phone calls, that we decided we were going to move forward.
So for over 12 years, we've done medical podcasting. Now we're doing it under the banner of Texas Tech University Health Science Center El Paso, and I'm pleased to be recording with you again, Elizabeth. I've missed you.
Me too. Gosh, I really missed you.
And our listeners as well.
That's exactly right. Let's turn then to the studies where we're going to do them slightly differently compared to how we did them before. We're going to serve up kind of an abstract version of each study, and then we're going to talk about it. So I said, gosh, do we have anything to offer women with ovarian cancer? This is a study that's in the New England Journal of Medicine where 245 women who had ovarian cancer and had been previously treated were randomized to receive either hyperthermic intraperitoneal chemotherapy, wow, there's a term for you, during surgery or not. And it took a look at both disease-free survival and overall survival. What it found was that the women who had the intraoperative chemotherapy survived for just over 14 months, while those who had surgery alone survived for just under 11 months. That is significant in both disease-free and overall survival for a disease that is associated with a really poor prognosis.
So Elizabeth, by the time women are diagnosed with ovarian cancer, oftentimes it is already metastasized. That's usually inside the abdomen or what's called in the peritoneum. And at that point, therapy consists of giving both chemotherapy to reduce the size or to shrink the tumor, and also doing what's called cytoreductive surgery. They do surgery where they open the peritoneum, they open the abdominal wall, and take out as much tumor as they can. As you suggest, the overall outcome is oftentimes not very good, with about 50% of women having died within the next 4 or 5 years. This type of therapy, where we can actually give high-dose chemotherapy directly in the abdominal wall, that is, you apply it to the tumor, it's heated, and that actually increases the absorption of the chemotherapy. It does improve overall survival, it improves recurrence-free survival, and it also increases the duration survival. So again, a modest benefit, but for an extra 2 hours in the operating room, I think this is important news.
Important, of course, because gosh, we have not even a single method for screening for ovarian cancer, yet a large number of deaths that take place every year as a result of it.
Yeah, you'd like to get a screening technique so that it detects cancer in its very early stages. And that's what's been so elusive in ovarian cancer. You're absolutely right. So even though this is a modest improvement, it is an improvement. And that's why I think it's worth telling our listeners about it.
Excellent. Let's move from here then to this huge, voluminous issue in JAMA, the entire thing devoted to the management of obesity and largely focused on surgery.
These are five different studies that include over 35,000 patients looking at two different aspects. One is comparing bariatric surgery to traditional medical therapy for obesity, and the other are comparing two different types of bariatric surgery. The short version is, when you compare bariatric surgery to medical therapy, individuals that have bariatric surgery over the course of 4 years, it reduces their mortality by 50%. From 2.3 to 1.3%, and it makes their traditional risk factors like diabetes, hypertension, and high cholesterol easier to control and more likely to be within the guidelines. So bariatric surgery for individuals that are morbidly obese and aren't responsive to traditional therapy seems to be better than medical therapy. Now, when you compare the two different types of surgery, sleeve gastrectomy to routine intestinal bypass, it looks like those two types of surgery end up giving very equivalent results. Both groups lose a lot of weight and lose a similar amount of weight. Both groups have similar short-term complications, fairly modest, a 1 or 2% short-term complications. About 1 in 10 individuals or 1 in 5 will need a reoperation, regardless of which type they initially started with. So it looks like individuals can choose either one. What's different is their long-term complications. Those that have the sleeve gastrectomy, the laparoscopic surgery, have a higher incidence of having either reflux start or reflux get worse. And that's not true with the other type of surgery.
This is sounding like a pretty complicated decision, at least to me. I'm wondering what advice you would give to patients right now who are contemplating bariatric surgery for the management of their morbid obesity.
Well, first of all, we try lifestyle interventions first to see whether that can be effective. Secondly, is if it's not, then I think the data are pretty convincing that bariatric surgery, even longer term for 5 or 10 years, does have some benefit. When you have to choose between the two, go to a surgeon that's familiar with both of those, recognizing that the outcome can be very similar, but the patient selection may be a little bit different. For example, if the patient already is suffering from significant GE reflux, the sleeve gastrectomy probably isn't the procedure of choice because it's likely to make it worse. Choosing a surgeon that's knowledgeable with both techniques is really incredibly important.
And of course, I have to add that public health message that obesity is not something that someone gets up one day and suddenly is obese. It's certainly something that accretes over time. And so I guess my message to our healthcare providers is this is something that we really need to pay attention to. And when someone comes and interacts with the healthcare system, we need to really say, hey, you know, I see things are headed with this trajectory. How can I help?
Absolutely. Intervene early, and the best intervention is caloric reduction, decreasing the number of calories we're eating. So you have to count them, you have to know about them, and then make sure that we're wise about our food choices.
Okay. Now we're going to turn to another one that I'm going to serve up. This one is in JAMA Internal Medicine. Pretty powerful study in my mind, a 30-year prospective study. And what it had a different intention, but one of the things it looked at was, hey, in women who breastfeed, is their incidence of diabetes reduced? And lo and behold, in over 1,200 women, about half of whom were Black women, who gave birth and breastfed their children, those women who breastfed longer had a reduction in their risk of developing diabetes.
In fact, the women that were breastfeeding 12 months or longer had about half the risk of diabetes as those that didn't breastfeed. The nice thing about this particular study, it is a prospective study over a long period of time. And furthermore, they actually did some biochemical testing that showed that the women who were breastfeeding actually had lower circulating glucose levels and less insulin secretion. So it actually has some biologic plausibility to explain why breastfeeding, even decades later, can reduce the incidence of diabetes. So again, another reason why we need to stress the importance of breastfeeding, not only for the infant, but also for the health of the mother as well.
Indeed, we know that there are so many things that are so powerfully beneficial about breastfeeding. It improves the bonding between mom and infant. It helps women manage that post-pregnancy weight gain that so many women experience. It's less expensive and it's convenient.
And I think this is a terrific study. As you mentioned, this was originally a study dealing with heart disease, but because they had been collecting this data for 30 years, they were able to go back and say, hey, listen, breastfeeding is also important for reducing the risk of diabetes.
Wonderful news. And finally, let us turn to your study. This is from the USPSTF, and I've been practicing low these many years now so that I can say that without tripping over my tongue. The United States Preventive Services Task Force. A look at what are so-called non-traditional risk factors for cardiovascular disease, and gosh, is there really an impact?
So what the USPSTF determined is that there's not enough evidence to make a recommendation on whether to add non-traditional risk factors to gauge an asymptomatic person's cardiovascular risk. Wow. Well, we know there are risk factors that do play an important part in determining the risk of heart disease, things like age and gender, somebody's race, what their cholesterol is, and their blood pressure, their diabetes, and their cigarette smoking. And you can take all of those risk factors and plug them into an equation and determine over the next 10 years what somebody's risk of having heart disease is. And by the way, if that risk is over 7.5% over that 10 years, you're considered to be at a high risk, and we need to intervene either with lifestyle changes or with medications to lower that risk. Well, there's scarcely a season that doesn't go by that I don't receive some type of bulletin from some imaging company and say, hey, we have these other tests looking for heart disease. These are things like a high sensitivity CRP, coronary artery calcifications, or something called an ankle brachial index, looking for arterial disease in your legs or your arms. But what the USPSTF says is there's not any evidence to suggest that it's any better than what we're currently doing, nor any evidence that if we change therapy based upon these non-traditional risk factors, it actually improves outcome. They're not recommending that individuals have these non-traditional risk factors done.
Well, as I've shared with you before, I had a coronary calcium scan just because I could, and I thought it might be kind of interesting and learned that, oh no, in spite of decades of exercising, I actually have a coronary calcium score. It's not very high. Certainly has been in the back of my mind, though, and a little bit worrisome. So my thought is, gosh, if we're going to assess something non-traditional and all it ends up doing is burdening someone's mind, that's probably not good either.
Right. So you got a little additional X-ray exposure. It provided information that really didn't change your outcome. It really didn't change your risk factors at all. So exactly my point, and the point of the USPSTF as well.
So we'll encourage our listeners to weigh in. Go on to their website, and there is public comment. You can write on there and say, hey, this is my experience with these things.
I like your pun. After we talked about obesity, you're talking about weighing in on things. I caught that, Elizabeth.
On that note, we are actually doing a blog again. So we're going to encourage you to go ahead and visit our blog. And I'm going to do the same thing. Hold forth on some study this week that really has spoken to my heart. In this case, it's going to be the breastfeeding study. And all of the hyperlinks for all of the studies will be there. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.